Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Okay, here you go. CPI and SVB in that order from APM. See what I did there? American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 14th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Silicon Valley Bank, the aftermath coming up through most of the rest of the program. But we begin today with the macroeconomic number of the day. It is 6. That is the headline number for the Consumer Price Index, brought to us this morning by the good people at the Labor Department. It is still high. Yes, and triple where the Federal Reserve would like to see inflation, but this makes 8 months in a row now that the rate of price increases has slowed. Now, one of the big reasons it hasn't slowed more is how much it costs to keep a roof over our heads. Shelter, says the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is driving more than 70% of inflation right now. At the same time, though, the Fed's rising interest rates are having quite an impact on real estate, including rents. So with that in mind, Marketplace's Samantha Fields gets us going.
Think back to the first year or two of the pandemic, when the housing market and later the rental market really took off.
It took some time for that strength to show up in inflation.
Allie Wolf is chief economist at the housing data and consultancy firm Zonda.
We didn't see that much inflation from shelter in early 2021.
Even though it was absolutely already happening.
The same thing's now happening on reverse, where we know that housing was one of the first sectors to slow in the wider economy, and yet today's inflation release is still showing that overall shelter is growing at a pretty rapid pace.
It generally takes 6 to 12 months or even longer for changes in rents and housing costs to show up in inflation data. And Wolf says the rental market didn't really start to slow until the end of last year, less than 6 months ago.
That means when we're looking at the shelter component of the consumer price index, we're really looking at a shadow of the housing market, where it was recently, not where it is now or where it's headed.
Igor Popov, chief economist at Apartment List, says if you look instead at what's happening in real time, it's pretty clear.
Rising interest rates have already done their job on the housing market.
The Fed obviously knows all this, says Lisa Sturdivant, chief economist at Bright MLS.
And so there's been a lot more attention being paid not only to core inflation, right, which removes the volatile sectors of food and energy, but now this idea of super core inflation, which also takes out housing from the overall CPI.
Not because it's volatile, but because it's lagging. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, regional banks bounce back a little bit. The major indices seem to have forgotten all about SVB. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The investigations into how what happened at Silicon Valley Bank happened and why it happened have started. The Justice Department is reported to have taken an interest, the Securities and Exchange Commission, too, and the Federal Reserve itself, as we mentioned yesterday, has launched an internal probe of the oversight and supervision of SVB. Daniel Tarullo knows a thing or two about the Fed and bank supervision. He's at Harvard Law now, but he was on the Board of Governors at the Fed from 2009 to 2017, including 4 years chairing the Fed's Committee on Supervision and Regulation. Mr. Tarullo, it's good to have you back on, sir.
Nice to be back, Kai.
With the stipulation that this is not 2008-2009, what do you suppose it was like in the Fed Friday afternoon and Saturday?
Well, I suspect that they were scrambling. The problems with Silicon Valley Bank came with very little or no warning. You know, usually, Kai, when you've got financial stress of some sort, you have at least some indications that it's going to happen. The adrenaline level still goes up once it starts, but at least you've had a chance to think it through. And here, I suspect that even their diagnosis of what was going on was not very firm, and as I understand it, changed over the course of the weekend.
All right, so look, that's why we got you on the phone. You ran, among other things you did at the Fed while you were there, you ran the Committee on Supervision and Regulation. And I am not the first person to ask, nor will I be the first person to ask, where were the regulators? Why did this come out of the blue?
Well, that's the huge question, isn't it? There are two places to look. One is to supervision, and the other is to regulation. Now, of course, we're stipulating that there's a management failure, but mm-hmm. I think everybody yep. would agree with that. So in terms of the government, the debate publicly has been, gee, were the 2018-2019 changes right. in the law and Fed regulations respectively to blame? And as I think you know, I was opposed to both the law and the changes in the regulations. But I don't mm-hmm. think there's that direct a connection between those specific changes and Silicon Valley. And so what that tells us is the failure was in the oversight by supervisors, people who were supposed to be watching whether things like the proportion of uninsured deposits was creating some unusual risks for that particular bank.
That's not terribly reassuring, I got to tell you.
No, it's not. And I think that the review that the Fed has launched, and it's significant that it's headed by the Vice Chair for Supervision, Michael Barr, who, mm-hmm. as you know, is relatively new. I think the significance mm-hmm. of having him run that rather than staff is precisely because they want to find out where the supervisory failures lay. Were they with the specific team that had responsibility for Silicon Valley, or were the failures more widespread in the sense that Washington was providing kind of a light-touch supervisory direction to them?
What do you think?
I suspect that it's a combination of the two. But given the signals that the Fed was sending, you know, in the last several years, I believe that part mm-hmm. of it is just the don't be too tight in your supervision. You need to find legal problems before you tell the banks to change what they were doing.
Hmm. With the barn door firmly open and the horse gone, let me ask you about what happens next. First of all, on this idea that the Fed and the FDIC and the Treasury over the weekend invoked the systemic risk exception to cover uninsured depositors. Can we read that as functionally now, all deposits in American banks are basically insured?
Well, there's a deep irony here, isn't there, Kai? Because if you are a large depositor, you are now saying to yourself, you know what? If I put my large deposit into a bank that already has a bunch of large uninsured deposits, then I'm more likely to get bailed out because they're worried about the run.
Right.
So
right.
clearly, the regulatory approach is going to have to change here because that's the worst kind of incentive. I agree with the premise of your question that we've just seen an uptick in moral hazard. And look, when the 16th largest bank in the country, we're not talking Citi, we're not talking JP Morgan, we're not talking Wells Fargo, the 16th largest bank cannot be allowed to fail under the normal rules that apply to bank failures. That really does tell you that one of those pillars of Dodd-Frank, which is let banks fail and the people will have the right incentives, we just can't rely on that.
So now what happens in the weeks and months to come? There's going to be the Fed review. Congress will surely be involved. More mm-hmm. regulations coming? What do you think?
I do think there'll be more regulation. I would expect that there may be some rollback on the deregulatory changes, particularly the Fed's 2019 regulation. But the scope of those, Kai, I think is going to depend on what they learn, how many banks were vulnerable.
Yeah.
The other thing which people do need to discuss, even though it has some politically unappealing attributes to it, is should we be insuring more than $250,000? And if the answer, the reason for that, of course, is you prevent runs and you prevent money mm-hmm. moving to money market funds. But if you do that, you really do need more stringent regulation of the banks that hold those large but now insured deposits.
And that will be quite the fight, right? I mean, you've spent enough time in Washington to know that there's going to be a knockdown dragout over that.
Absolutely. This is not going to be the political no-brainer.
Daniel Tarullo teaches at Harvard Law now. For our purposes, though, was on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors for 8 or 9 years, where he ran the Committee on Supervision and Regulation. Mr. Tarullo, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Good talking to you again, Kai.
You know, most of the conversation about SVB and banking regulation, including me and Dan Tarullo just now, has been about federal supervision, the Federal Reserve and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in particular. But it was state regulators in California and New York that shut down SVB and Signature Bank. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more now on what states do to keep an eye on the banking sector.
States play a major role in regulating finance, says Aaron Klein, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
They regulate all of insurance. They regulate many banks. They regulate many credit unions.
In fact, Klein says states were the only bank regulators throughout much of U.S. history.
America only had state-chartered banks until the Civil War. And up until the 1990s, most banks, regardless of federal or state charter, couldn't really branch and exist outside of their main state.
Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank were both state-chartered. That's why state regulators stepped in first. Cornelius Hurley teaches financial services law at Boston University.
At the end of the day, it is the state banking authority that has the authority to remove that charter, to revoke that charter, and to put it into receivership when it goes insolvent.
Thing is, state regulators tend to be focused on what happens within their states, says Catherine Judge, a law professor at Columbia.
And no matter how diligent New York regulators are, it's not the role of New York regulators to try to figure out what the consequences might be in other states should a New York bank fail.
But Judge says the recent failures are so big that they could have systemic consequences. And in cases like these,
the onus is always going to land on federal regulators to really make sure they understand what are the risks to which this institution is exposed? What are the steps it's taking to manage those risks?
Judge says that's why state and federal regulators acted together. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
burlap, hides, tallow.
That is not a 19th century grocery list, despite what you might think. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 336 today. SVB, what SVB? Almost 1.1% on the blue chips, 32,155. The NASDAQ up 239 points. That is 2.1%. On the percent scale, close at 11,428. The S&P 500 increased by 64 points, about 1.2%, 39.20. Meta Platforms, which is, of course, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, announced it would lay off 10,000 people this year. That is the second time in less than 6 months that it's announced major job cuts. It's also going to leave 5,000 positions vacant and unfilled. Meta shares, in that funny way that this works, up 7.25% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You heard Dan Tarullo talking about this a little bit ago, the prospect of new banking regulations coming our way. Negotiations will surely be long and drawn out, but history can be a guide here. After the Great Depression came the FDIC. After the 1980s savings and loan crisis came the no longer with us Office of Thrift Supervision. And after the Great Recession, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes on what might be ahead now, regulations-wise.
A lot of government employees owe their jobs to banks behaving badly. Jonah Crane used to be one of them. He worked for the Financial Stability Oversight Council that was created at the Treasury Department following the 2008 financial crisis.
On weekends like this, I both miss it and I'm really thankful that I'm not there.
Crane's now a partner at the financial advisory firm Claros Group. He doesn't expect any new regulatory bodies to be created, but he does expect existing regulators to consider bringing back some regulations for banks of a certain size.
In particular, regulations around how much liquidity these banks had to hold. That, at the end of the day, is a big piece of what did in Silicon Valley Bank.
Meanwhile, existing regulators are doing some soul searching. It was the responsibility of the San Francisco Fed to supervise Silicon Valley Bank. And the Federal Reserve Board announced yesterday that it's going to review what happened.
It's like the regulator going into the principal's office.
David Beckworth is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason.
Why didn't you get this figured out the first time, you know?
Banks themselves also need to take a closer look at their own internal regulation, including the expertise of their board's risk committees, says University of Maryland business professor Clifford Rossi.
They're like the first line of defense in knowing where the bodies are buried on these companies. And if they're just passively going along, you're not going to change it. I don't care how much regulation you heap on them.
Because, as Treasury alum Jonah Crane points out, Silicon Valley Bank may be a harbinger of other banks with similar money problems. And it's up to regulators inside the institutions and out to find those problems before more banks fail. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
Federal Reserve meets next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and after today's CPI report and the collapse of SVB, it is anybody's guess what's going to happen with interest rates. But at least as interesting as the rates decision is going to be, this meeting is one of the four times a year that the central bank releases its summary of economic projections. It sounds authoritative, I suppose, but as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, the Fed's crystal ball does sometimes get a little cloudy.
For decades, the Fed was mysterious. Predicting what it would do, that was an art form. When Alan Greenspan was chair, people watched his briefcase when he walked into the Fed building. If it was bulging, the thinking was it was filled with evidence he would use to push for an interest rate hike. But since 2007, we've had the summary of economic projections.
I would describe this as a survey. It's like an opinion poll.
That's Andrew Levin, an economics professor at Dartmouth College. He's also a former Fed economist, and he helped design the summary, a series of questions four times a year for the panel of Fed governors and regional Fed bank presidents that sets interest rates, the Federal Open Market Committee.
The survey is usually done in the previous few days before each policy meeting. They fill out a survey form, and then the Federal Reserve staff tabulates it.
The survey asks the committee, hey, what's going to happen with the unemployment rate, inflation, and economic growth this year, next year, in the long run? And what are appropriate interest rates over that time? Former Philadelphia Fed President Charles Plosser worked with Levin to help create this summary of economic projections. The goal?
It's about communication and transparency.
About interest rates and where they're headed. Plosser says the summary also makes the Fed's job easier because it helps investors anticipate what the central bank will do.
Policy can be more effective and more beneficial when the public and the markets have a better understanding about what the Fed is doing and why.
But Plosser says some people take the word projections too literally. He says the Fed isn't committing to do anything. Bethann Bovino gets that. She's chief U.S. and Canadian economist at S&P Global Ratings. She says the projections are more of a signal of what the Fed could do next.
I do like their charts.
Bovino is talking about a graph of interest rate projections known as the dot plot. Each dot represents one prediction by a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. A quick glance at the dot plot shows you the range of views on rates from high to low.
I compare it with what it looked like the last time and maybe even the time before to get a sense of where they're turning. Are you starting to see those dots go up or go down?
And last year, they went up a lot. At first, the dots pointed to 3 interest rate hikes in 2022, but they kept marching up. And in the end, the Fed raised rates 7 times. At his last press conference of 2022 in December, Chair Jerome Powell said the economic projections could keep shifting.
Of course, these projections do not represent a committee decision or plan, and no one knows with any certainty where the economy will be a year or more from now.
In other words, investors don't trade on the Fed's summary of economic projections. That's Blarina Aruce's advice. She's chief U.S. economist for T. Rowe Price. She says, really, a Fed policymaker's guess is no better than anybody else's.
Because the forecast errors of the summary of economic projections have been about as large as they've been for private sector economists and the markets.
Aruce cuts Fed officials some slack because things like Russia's war in Ukraine, supply chain snarls, and a super tight labor market make forecasting anything in this post-pandemic economy especially difficult. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The big economic indicator of the day is, of course, the consumer price index that Sam Fields was talking about earlier. But the CPI is far from the only game in town. So this week, we're going to introduce you to some other less well-known, less celebrated, perhaps, economic indicators, but indicators that do help shed light on this economy, too. Today, it's the Commodity Research Bureau's Raw Industrials Index. It sounds weedy, I know, but it is relevant for all kinds of businesses.
My name is Sai Amesquita, and I'm a violin shop owner and maker in Omaha, Nebraska.
My name is Sonia Vasquez. I am the owner of Latina Natural. I work as an herbalist, a health coach, and an entrepreneur.
And last but not least,
my name is Eero Picot, and I'm the president of Barchart.
Barchart is a financial information company. It publishes the Raw Industrials Index, and we'll get to how that connects to a violin maker and an herbalist in a second. But first, a little historical context. The Raw Industrials Index is one of the oldest commodities indices we've got. Dates back to the aftermath of the Great Depression when the U.S. government decided to get more involved in tracking economic data.
And so a series of indexes were created, including the Raw Industrial Index.
It's been updated a couple of times since then. Today, it includes 13 items.
Hides.
As in cow hides.
Tallow.
That's animal fat.
Copper scrap. Lead scrap. Steel scrap. Zinc. Tin.
Okay, so some metals too.
Burlap. Cotton. Print cloth. Wool tops. Rosin. And rubber.
I mean, kind of random sounding, right?
This is true, but these are crucial to the core parts of industries.
Which is where all those small businesses come in.
We make soaps, we make candles, salves, balms, lotions, everything that you can imagine that you can apply on your skin.
That's Sonia Vasquez at Latina Natural.
All of them are made with grass-fed beef tallow.
Rosin, another item in the Raw Industrials Index.
It's a refined tree sap.
Sai Amesquita again, the violin maker.
We, in the trade, use it on bows. And the rosin is put on the horsehair so that it can actually grab the string and create the sounds that you hear.
Rosin also gets used in ink and glues, pharmaceuticals, even chewing gum. I should note, by the way, that there are quite a few indices out there tracking different combinations of commodities. You hear us mention some of them from time to time. Raw Industrials, though, is a favorite. Eero Picot at Barchart again.
And that's because it is essentially a predictor of some of the macroeconomic trends that happen 3-6 months down the line.
The Raw Industrials Index is down about 20% since the Fed started raising rates almost a year ago. Kind of flat lately, though.
So the last one or two interest rate hikes haven't really had the same deflationary impact as perhaps the Fed would be hoping.
There you have it, the Raw Industrials Index. More unsung indicators coming later this week.
This final note on the way out today comes with the understanding that this is an approximation. Today is widely recognized as Equal Pay Day. That day into the next year that a woman working full-time has to work to earn what a man working full-time made in the prior year alone. It's 2.5 months, if you're counting. And it does get worse by race and ethnicity. Equal Pay Day is April 5th for Asian American and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander women, July 27th for Black women, October 5th for Latina women, and November 30th for Native and Indigenous women. The data, by the way, is from the group Equal Pay Today. All right, we are going here, though, is your moment of economic context. You might have seen Moody's, the ratings people, came out today and changed its view of the entire American banking sector from stable to negative. That is because, Moody's said, and this is the quote, rapid deterioration in the operating environment following deposit runs at Silicon Valley Bank, Silvergate Bank, and Signature Bank. To be clear here, the American banking system is stable. Your money is safe. This one's all about bank credit ratings and borrowing costs. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Dylan Mieted, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.